Hello and welcome to Undivided on this Tuesday. I'm Brandi Cruz. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your continuing commitment to give common sense a comeback. We're coming to you on Tuesday today because yesterday was a holiday and hopefully you enjoyed some time with family and friends. It was pretty nice out in the Seattle area if you were if you're here. So it was a nice change of pace. So I always want to try to get you guys off your computers, out interacting with the real world, maybe just completely ignoring politics when you have an opportunity to do so. Good show for you today. I talked on the show last Wednesday, the subscriber-only episode, about what I think is the most dangerous proposal to come out of the pandemic, and that is down in California, and it was passed through the assembly there, that would prevent doctors or nurses from sharing misinformation or disinformation about COVID-19. Misinformation, as I explained last week, has a very broad definition. And so in my view, this is very dangerous to allow the government essentially to determine what misinformation might be and to take a doctor's license away for something that could change from month to month, from year to year. So I'm gonna be joined by a California doctor who's a really smart guy. He's been trying to raise awareness for this bill down in California, and I really like him because whatever the topic is, you know, I've seen him do interviews, for instance, on the issue of transgender teens and what medical care, you know, they should be provided and at what age. And his real message is always just take the politics out of medicine. And so that's the lens under which he's going to be discussing this issue today. I'm also going to talk about what I believe is the single biggest issue that's keeping our political discourse from improving in America. I did a little experiment on Twitter that I think was very telling. But first, I'm excited today because I'm going to be announcing kind of a new chapter in Undivided and in this mission. How do I open the show every time? I open the show by saying thank you for your continuing commitment to give common sense a comeback. And that's what this is about. It's about trying to return common sense to our conversations around politics, to how we cover stories as members of the media. And it's a mission I really believe in, especially in a state like Washington, where you, for the most part, have one-party rule. And so sometimes they don't have to look at things through the lens of common sense. If they think it's a good idea, they just push it through and really don't give it a second thought. And to me, I think that this mission has to be more than me just sitting here giving my opinion. You know, and I want it to be more than that. And I want to try to together influence policy in a meaningful way, or at least encourage politicians in a meaningful way to look at things through a lens of common sense. So today I'm going to be launching a partnership with Future 42. Future 42 is an organization that is dedicated to trying to help Washington State reach its full potential. If you're wondering what the 42 stands for, Washington, the 42nd state in the union. So across social media this evening, I'll be posting the following video, but I wanted you to see it first. I'm Brandi Cruz, and I've been covering politics in Washington State for about a decade. When I first moved to Seattle, it was one of the most beautiful cities I'd ever seen, in the most beautiful state I'd ever set foot in. But it's getting harder and harder to appreciate or even remember all the things I loved about this place. This isn't about politics or opinions. We all see what's happening. More and more people are suffering on our streets, right in front of our eyes, falling deeper into mental illness and drug addiction. This is not the future we deserve. Dangerous criminals are explicitly using laws passed by our elected leaders to avoid arrest.
They're not supposed to be able to change.
Okay.
People are being killed at record levels. The numbers do not lie. Many of them young men with a lifetime of potential. This is not the future we deserve. With violent crime up 12%, we have the lowest number of police officers per capita of any state in the nation. Yet it took 2 years for our governor to condemn police defunding.
This defund the police movement, I don't agree with it.
This is not the future we deserve. So let's change it. Today, I'm announcing a partnership with Future 42, an effort to build a future that's worthy of this wonderful place we call home. Because if we just stand back and wait for things to change, we might be waiting for a very long time. To turn your frustration into action, sign up at future42.org and watch Undivided with me, Brandi Cruz, every Monday as we highlight common sense solutions to the challenges we face. because this isn't just about Seattle. It's about the future of our entire state. So as an ambassador for Future 42, every single Monday on Undivided, we'll be focusing on an issue that's really in line with our joint mission. And again, that's bringing common sense back into some of the issues that are vexing our state. Issues like crime, homelessness, substance abuse, taxes and spending and transportation. And so every single Monday on the show, we'll have an interview or a segment that looks at common sense ways that we can really address some of the challenges facing Washington. I do want to let you know, as part of this partnership, I maintain full editorial control over all the content that I'm putting out there. Future 42 and Undivided, we really share a mission. And so I think a lot of our thoughts on some of these issues are going to be very similar. But every segment that I put out under the Future 42 partnership is something that I'm going to maintain control over. And I think that that's important for you to know as well. So if you're someone who listens to this podcast, what that tells me is that you care deeply about the state of Washington. I know a lot of you live in Washington, some may not, but we care deeply about the state of the country and the direction of things, and we want our political system to work better. And so this is a great way for you to do something more than just complain on social media or be angry about the state of things. So go to future42.org, sign up for their newsletter, and it's a really good place to go to start putting your frustration toward action. And I think when we get all the folks who have common sense in this state on board in a singular mission, I really think it can make a difference over time. So again, excited today to announce an ongoing partnership with Future 42. And together, we are going to help continue this movement to give common sense a comeback. I got some of you folks riled up over the weekend. Man, I sent out just a regular Sunday newsletter Sunday mornings on Patreon and Locals, and it essentially sums up some of the segments that we did throughout the week, some of the other things that are going on in the country. And, you know, usually it's pretty innocuous. Usually it's not too controversial. Apparently this one was. So in my weekly Sunday newsletter, I talked about, of course, Biden's speech vilifying MAGA Republicans.
MAGA Republicans have made their choice. They embrace anger. They thrive on chaos. They live not in the light of truth, but in the shadow of lies.
It's something we discussed at length on the show last week. I offered my condemnation of the framing of the president's speech, especially considering, you know, he said he was going to be a president for everyone. He was going to bridge the political divides in our country. And now he's really going full in on this vilification of an entire voting base in America, millions and millions of Americans who he's supposed to be the president for. And I just don't think it's in keeping with what he promised he was going to do for this country. I think there's a better way to go about it. I mean, you look at every single tweet, go to the president's Twitter account. MAGA Republicans, MAGA Republicans. It's a clear strategy. And also I knocked him for the fact that the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee propped up the campaigns of some of those very same candidates to try to push them through to November because they think they can beat them. And so it's all just a little hypocritical to me. And then a couple days later, former President Donald Trump held his first rally post FBI raid on Mar-a-Lago. He happened to also do it in Pennsylvania, just a couple hours away from where Biden had given his speech in Philadelphia. In fact, Trump gave his speech very close to Scranton, which is the president's hometown. And, you know, Trump's rallies, he always has a certain, what's a good way to put this? It's like his tone is enthusiastic, but the stuff he says can still be really hateful. You know, he called Biden the enemy of the state. He's calling the sitting president the enemy of the state. And he had other insulting things to say about Democrats.
Fetterman got it, and he got it in a landslide. And this guy's a disaster. He comes in with a sweatsuit on. I've never seen him wear a suit. A dirty, dirty, dirty sweatsuit. It's really disgusting. You know, I'm a clean freak. I'm a clean freak, Oz. I don't like those dirty sweatsuits. They're disgusting. Fetterman may dress like a teenager getting high in his parents' basement, but he's a raging lunatic hell-bent on springing hardened criminals out of jail in the middle of the worst crime wave.
So what I pointed out in my newsletter is here you have Biden who says, you know, MAGA Republicans, they're all about fear. and anger. And then you have Trump 2 days later that holds a rally where he's insulting, you know, people. And I think despite his tone, you know, some people were saying, oh, they were doing the wave. It wasn't an angry rally. You can have a very positive tone, but the words you say contradict that. And so the point I was saying on my Sunday newsletter is that, you know, Trump basically proved Biden's point that Biden gave in the speech. And I said, you have these two men who, you know, the language they use is divisive. It's not doing anything to bring the country together. And the closing point I made is I just believe that we can do better. I refuse to believe that we can't do better. So anyway, I posted this newsletter and the responses were very predictable. And they indicate, as I said, what I believe is the single biggest challenge that is preventing our country from moving forward in a positive way. So on the left, folks who read it condemned me for daring to compare President Biden's speech to Trump's rally. And then on the right, folks on social media condemned me for daring to compare Trump's rally to President Biden's speech. I pulled up just a few examples of responses I got. Brandi Cruz, queen of the absurd whataboutism, admit that you are just like your right-wing bosses. Okay, you guys are my bosses, so I don't know what they're referring to, but let's see. Another one, this one from the right. If that's your takeaway, then your Trump derangement syndrome is stronger than I thought. Okay, let's see another one from the left. Biden's beef is with election-denying, insurrectionist, MAGA cultists, and he's 100% correct with everything he said. Let's do one more from the right. The only anger Trump trafficked in was the fact that Democrats are terrified of what's coming. All right, so on and so forth. So you can see that people fall into two very distinct camps. Either they were very upset that I would claim Biden's speech was somehow worse than Trump's or the same as Trump's, or they were very upset that I would say Trump's rally was somehow just as bad as Biden's. There are very few people I saw who were willing to find fault with their own side, or were willing to find fault with both sides. And one of the biggest misperceptions, because I get accused of whataboutism a lot. For example, back during January 6th, I strongly condemned the January 6th riot. One of the points I had made is that, you know, I wish Democrats had also condemned the riots that happened across the country for months on end in 2020. Now, I wasn't comparing them, saying January 6th was just as bad as what happened, you know, in Seattle, for instance. What I was saying is this was bad and this was bad, and we should be able to condemn both of them. And you just had people, particularly Democrats, who were like, how could you compare an insurrection to protests across the country? And then you had people on the right, Trump supporters, who were like, how could you compare this gathering at the Capitol to the violent riots across the country? It's like they always have to be, the assumption is that I'm trying to always put things on the same footing. Like these things are exactly the same and we should condemn them in the exact same way. And that's not what I'm saying. One of the tenets of Undivided is actions before affiliation, is returning to a place where we can condemn someone's actions completely separate from their affiliation, that we give no care or concern for someone's political affiliation when we're judging something they said or when we're judging something they did. And that was my take on the riots all along, is whether you tried to light a police precinct on fire in Seattle over the murder of George Floyd, or whether you assaulted a police officer at the nation's capital because you wanted the election to have turned out differently, you committed a crime, and I want you held accountable for that. And, you know, after I saw all of these responses from the left and from the right, just outraged that I would dare condemn both of these men for being so divisive in their wording, I did a little experiment on Twitter. I posted a Twitter poll. Here's a question. If your kid was a bully and your neighbor's kid was a bully, which kid would you be more upset with? 73% of people said, well, my kid, if my kid was a bully, that's my responsibility. I'm more upset with my child. 5% said the neighbor's kid. 23% said both equally. And I all along knew that this was going to prove my point, which is if you take out the word kid and you replace it with political party, then our answer should be the same, right? If your political party was a bully and your neighbor's political party was a bully, which political party would you be more upset with? But I would tend to believe that in practice, people would say, well, the neighbor's political party, because that's how we act, right? We, for some reason, expect less of our own political party than we do of someone else's. Which is odd, because in the question about if your kid was a bully and your neighbor's kid was a bully, who would you be more upset with? Most people would say, well, my kid. You know, if you're part of a political party, if you vote for members of a political party, you're buying into that political party. You have some responsibility there if you're helping to elect people of that party. Those are the people who are going to represent you in Congress or in state houses. Shouldn't you expect more of them? Shouldn't you expect the most of them if that's who you've given your vote to? So why is it that when we talk about political parties, we expect so much more of a political party that we're not even voting for? That doesn't make any sense to me. And I really believe that if we can't, and if we're not willing to try to keep our own house in order, then we really have no standing to be able to criticize the other house. You know, like in the example of the kids and the bully. If my kid's a bully and I haven't done anything about that, then who am I to judge the neighbor's kid for being a bully as well? Who am I to go over to my neighbor and say, your kid's a bully? Your kid's a bad person. You need to do more to keep your kid in line. That would be very hypocritical of me. And, you know, one of the other points I made, and we talk about this kind of race to the bottom, right? If I use, just as an example, if I use Trump's behavior to excuse anything Biden does, that's a fast track to the bottom. If I use Biden's behavior to excuse anything Trump does, you're lowering the bar, and that's a race to the bottom. And the trick is, for politicians, is they know that you're going to cut them slack if you support them. And they're relying on that to be able to get away with it. And, you know, my response to some of these criticisms was, if the standard we use to decide whether a politician's behavior is acceptable is whether another politician's behavior was worse, Lord help us. Because then you're in this constant, almost a competition to see if you can be worse than the other person. It's like, oh, Trump dropped things down to here. So now Democrats, we can go to that level. You go out even further, and then you go all the way down to the bottom, and things are worse than ever. So when I, you know, put this Sunday newsletter out saying, oh, well, you know, Trump had this rally and he's insulting his political opponents, acting like a child, and Biden, you know, has this scary speech where he's vilifying millions of Americans. Can't we do better than this? It's not about comparing the two. It's not about saying the two are equally as bad. It is about pointing out that both are bad and that we deserve better. And we should expect better, especially from our own political parties. Last week on the Wednesday subscriber-only episode, I talked about Assembly Bill 2098, which was passed out of the California Assembly. And it could mean that a doctor would lose their medical license in the state of California if they are deemed to have shared COVID disinformation or misinformation. And my primary concern with that is that the definitions of disinformation and misinformation were very vague, which allows the government a ton of latitude when it comes to who or what, you know, they decide is bad information that they can take someone's license away for. Just as an example, you know, the misinformation definition in AB 2098 was basically information that goes against current scientific consensus, okay, on COVID-19. Hasn't scientific consensus changed during the course of the pandemic? You know, on whether people needed to wear masks, or who needed to wear masks, on, you know, the lab leak theory and whether that was a conspiracy or actually something that was legitimate. You know, we learn, and even vaccines, I mean, at the beginning, they were all saying, well, vaccines will prevent you from getting COVID. And clearly that's not the case. It prevented you from getting seriously sick or dying. But we've seen that people who've had the vaccine at a very high rate can get reinfected. And so that's very concerning when you have a virus that is constantly changing, but you're going to strip someone of their medical license for sharing what might be against scientific consensus at the time. So there's a doctor down in California, Dr. Uman Hammadi, who has been trying to raise awareness for this. He and I chatted about what he thinks the impact will be on doctors in California if Gavin Newsom signs this into law. Dr. Hammadi, welcome to Undivided. I appreciate you being here. Give us a little cliff notes of your resume. Why are you qualified to talk about this?
Certainly. I think first, I'm a physician. I'm a board certified licensed physician in California, have been very active for the last handful of years since COVID started on trying to depoliticize medicine on a national level, as well as on a state and local level. I've been working very hard kind of at a grassroots level among other physicians, as well as other parents. I'm a parent of two children in the school system as well, to try to take politics out of our medical decision-making and our public health decision-making and try to make decisions based on really what's right for people, what's evidence-based, so that we can make the right decisions regardless of any political affiliation.
Which is what people who practice medicine should do. And I told you before we started, I've watched a few interviews you've done on a variety of controversial issues, including, you know, care for transgender teens. And I really admire your constant sort of push to take the politics out of it. I think it's difficult to do these days. And so I think you've done a really effective job, which is why we're having you on. I told you, I think you're perfect to have this conversation on the show. So we've discussed Assembly Bill 2098. When did this first pop on your radar that this was something being floated in California?
You know, it's a few months ago that it came on my radar, as well as the radar of a handful of other physicians who try to track these things. It's only become more recently since it actually passed the state legislature, which many didn't believe it would happen because of how ludicrous it sounds when you just look at what it has in it, that really people began to take notice of it and basically become fearful that it will gain passage and become law.
What has the press attention been like? You know, we've had some bills up here that passed and everybody was like shocked by it because they didn't even really hear about it. Most of the ones up here had to do with crime bills. Was there a lot of attention to it leading up to that passage?
No. I mean, it's been that the California state legislature toward the end of its legislative session was very smart about trying to very quietly push things through at the 11th hour before anyone really noticed what was going on. And I think this was bundled in alongside a lot of really other horrible bills. A few good ones, but mostly horrible ones. A couple didn't pass, many did.
So there are, as you know, as a doctor, there are a ton of rules and regulations that you have to follow to be able to keep your license to practice medicine. Why do you see this one as being problematic?
Well, look, AB 2098 singles out COVID among every disease that's out there, whether it's any infectious diseases that are not COVID, oncology, anything from birth control to preventative health, such as, you know, diet and exercise and smoking cessation, across the spectrum. It singles COVID out. And then within COVID, beyond just singling it out and having special rules to it, singles it out for misinformation and then doesn't actually list what is real information and misinformation. It basically gives an arbitrary definition, and that arbitrary definition is to be decided by people who are not physicians. And that's really the frightening part, especially because COVID is relatively new as infectious diseases go. It's only been around for a couple of years. And as you know very well, what's misinformation today is fact tomorrow and vice versa. This is continually evolving. The virus evolves, our understanding of it evolves, our availability of vaccines and medications and the new data regarding the safety and efficacy of vaccines and medications evolves over time. And so with that, how in the world can anyone label anything as misinformation in such a sort of concrete, yet also abstract and arbitrary manner, especially when it comes to something like this, where there is an art and a science to medical practice, where there is such a thing as medical opinion, and where physicians are, in every other case except for COVID, free to interpret the data and individualize their recommendations to each patient.
Yeah, as you said, incredibly vague definitions for disinformation and misinformation, which are two different things. But I think what I'm confused by, and maybe you can provide clarity, maybe you can't, the definition of misinformation says things that go against contemporary scientific consensus. What is contemporary scientific consensus?
That's the problem. This is not a term that anyone's really accustomed to hearing, right? We're accustomed to hearing according to clinical evidence that refers to what's in the published medical literature, in the peer-reviewed published medical literature. There's a second term called standard of care. Standard of care is actually a legal term. When there's a malpractice lawsuit, for example, and a plaintiff is alleging that they were harmed by a physician, that physician had to have breached the standard of care in the community, which doesn't necessarily equate to what the evidence-based medical literature says. Rather, it's how medicine is practiced within that community, even if that practice deviates somewhat from established medical fact. This is neither. This is rather referring, bringing aboard a new term that the medical board and the politicians are going to define, which gives them a lot of leeway to call it what they want to call it. And one of the key signals of that, one of the hints that they gave, is that later in that bill's text, if you read it, right, they referenced major media, right, and how major media have identified physicians as a key source of misinformation about COVID. Well, if the same people who are talking about this new term of, you know, scientific consensus are also referring to the major media as a source of credible information regarding what is and isn't misinformation, could you put two and two together and say, well, they're going to go based on what the media claims is misinformation with respect to making disciplinary actions against physicians? We know major media is biased, right? There's inherent bias in any media. You shouldn't be making decisions regarding what's medical fact and what isn't, what's harmful or beneficial to patients based on what anyone in the media says, especially regarding COVID, now that it's been so politicized and sensationalized. I think we have to move far from that rather than gravitating toward it.
Well, if they're going to rely on the media, really they're relying on politicians, because the media has basically parroted whatever, you know, comes from the government on, you know, scientific consensus on COVID-19. Some of that, as you pointed out, has turned out to be untrue. So I guess I'm curious, if Newsom signs this into law, and let's say you go out and you say something about COVID on Twitter that someone flags as possible misinformation, what is the entity that would decide whether to take your license away?
Well, so this actually is, there are two parts to this. One is, it's unclear whether anything that's said in a social media context or on the regular media will even be subject to scrutiny based on AB 2098. There's been a concern about that. If you read it very carefully, it does talk about, in a way that could be vague, about fake patients and their recommendations to physicians and their recommendations to individual patients, not necessarily broad blanket statements that they make in a public setting. So this could not, this may not actually, in a legal sense, apply to comments that people make in a public forum. It may rather apply more narrowly to what patients tell their patients hear from their individual physicians. That may be a little bit of an icing on the cake. Despite that, it's not necessarily correct. Beyond that, I think it goes to the medical board. If you look at who the greatest proponent of AB 2098 is, it's the head of the California Medical Board, who's a lawyer, who's a litigator. It's somebody who's was appointed by the governor. Somebody clearly had connections to the governor and was appointed because of the governor's belief that she would be loyal to whatever the interests of patients are. But that calls into question, again, from a litigator's perspective, where, what are they really looking at? Are they looking from a medical malpractice angle and a patient harm angle, or are they looking truly through an actual medical clinical evidence angle? And that's really where part of the concern is.
So you're an eye surgeon, correct?
Yes.
So obviously you're not treating people for COVID as part of that, I don't think, unless there's some eye impact to COVID that I'm not aware of.
Those rarely happen, but ophthalmologists are not treating COVID patients on a day-to-day basis.
So let's say that you've got a patient who's in seeing you and they've asked you, oh, should I get a booster? And you give them some advice. Even though you're not treating COVID patients, is it something that could impact you if you offer advice to patients?
Certainly. And look, and anytime a physician offers advice, their judgment can impact their patient and can impact themselves. But this is why medical advice is exactly that. It's medical advice. It's not a medical order, right? Anytime a physician gives advice to a patient, that advice doesn't have to be followed, right? And anytime an advice is given, it should be given in the context of a discussion around the risks, benefits, and alternatives to that advice. So the patient can make their own informed decision, knowing what the alternatives are and what the risks are, and make an individual choice based on that. Moreover, there's a reason why we have a concept of a second opinion in medicine, right? We don't call it a second fact, or we don't just call it opinion or fact without any second option, right? There's a reason why second and third opinions are there. Because if medicine were a true hard science, where every patient would get exactly the same care regardless of their individual background or needs, guess what? We wouldn't need doctors even. We can have computer algorithms taking care of patients. Many try to self-diagnose and self-manage using Google. And this is why that doesn't work, is because there is an art in addition to the science of medicine. And even in something that is really well documented and decided in the literature, there's an understanding that each patient still is different. And even if they're medically similar, their expectations, their cultures, their values, their goals for themselves are may differ from one patient to another. And that this is where physicians really come into play. It's having those individualized discussions. And so, yes, while a physician may make a recommendation or give advice to one thing, to do one thing or not to do another, that is usually an individualized decision. And that should be respected unless it deviates so far from what conventional notion is, from what the evidence says, from what the standard of care is, in which case, if it really truly does cause harm, there should be concern. But typically in the general scheme, medical licenses aren't threatened, revoked, or suspended for a single isolated case where there's a difference of opinion between a physician and another, or a physician and a medical board. It typically arises when there is a serious pattern of medical practice that is so egregiously outside of any established norm that you really can't find any physician out there who would defend it. And that's not what AB 2090 is talking about. It's singling out COVID as one particular disease where all of a sudden there are arbitrary rules set around what's happening. And the only thing we can think of is you know, this is some form of control, almost extortion over physicians to stop talking about COVID and just parroting what they hear, you know, said in the media, basically.
Well, and what do you think is going to happen among your colleagues? You know, are they just going to hold back what they truly, the advice they believe they should give to their patients if they feel like it's going to fly in the face of what the government or the media is saying? Or do you think that they're going to just continue on as they have been?
Yeah, I think we're going to see a few things happening. You know, the physicians who believe what the government and what the media like to say will clearly have a green light to continue saying that because they're safe. Physicians who may disagree may start practicing defensive medicine. And so they may say, we'll refuse to discuss COVID or treat COVID issues. I refer you to somebody else. This has already happened with patients who ask for COVID vaccine exemptions or mask exemptions. The state did threaten physicians by saying that we will consider suspending or revoking your license if you write vaccine exemptions for any patient, especially if you're not an infectious disease specialist, but really for anybody, because of this fear that inappropriate exemption letters are being written. All of a sudden, you saw physicians blanketly refuse. Physicians who've known patients for years and who may have witnessed patients have an adverse reaction or have some sort of religious or other objection to it, or just medical concern over it, they refused and said, go see someone else. I'm not doing it because I can't I can't afford to risk my license. But on the other side, I think you're going to have physicians who will engage, who will, practice ethically, will speak what they believe to be true and individualize their comments and then deal with the ramifications of it. Remember, the medical board isn't necessarily going to start subpoenaing physicians' medical records and you know, bringing in their patients for questioning unless there's a complaint made, right? And what's going to trigger a complaint? Only really if there's a patient who has a serious problem and files a complaint with the medical board saying my physician did this or tried to do this. This is the harm that ensued from it. I'd like you to investigate. I don't see that happening on a very regular basis. The problem is if they begin to, you know, specifically solicit this or, you know, try to entrap physicians or take physicians who are making comments they don't like in the media. And there have been several who have been very outspoken, especially in the early days of COVID regarding off-label treatments before there were any approved treatments or vaccines. And I think there's always a chance that they'll go after those people using the language of AB2098. And that remains to be seen.
Entrapment is something that I was just thinking about, and I would not put that past people to, I mean, you're on TV, you go on Fox News sometimes. Does that worry you?
It doesn't worry me because everything I say is couched in medical evidence, right? I don't say anything that I don't have solid evidence-based fact backing it up. I don't make any comments, as you've heard, that are politically based. I never attack individuals or groups based on their political beliefs or even their medical beliefs. I like to just say what is objective fact. And in fact, in times when I've been questioned regarding vaccines, I won't necessarily go and say, don't get a vaccine. Of course, vaccines are useful in many situations outside of COVID in a major way. And even within COVID, there are absolutely groups and individuals who are at risk and who would definitely benefit from the vaccine in a case-by-case setting. But, and there are people who may not. But I think, again, what I'm pushing is not to blanketly say, get this or don't get this. It's to say, have a discussion with your physician, have that detailed review of the risks, benefits, and alternatives to every treatment option, to every vaccination option, even to masking, and make that decision for yourself rather than taking your medical advice from the media.
A couple quick things I want to fit in. And to me, this is the first question I ask with any bill is, is it necessary? Do you need it? And of course, I think everybody would agree, like, I don't want a doctor telling someone to just pulling a reference out, you know, drink bleach to kill COVID-19 or something. But wouldn't existing laws around malpractice and the ability of a patient to come forward if there's harm done, wouldn't that already cover something like that, something egregious like that?
Very good point. Absolutely. Right. For any other disease. Right? Existing laws and regulations completely cover what we're talking about, right? If a physician were to give misinformation regarding cancer therapy and tell a patient who would clearly benefit from a particular medication or chemotherapy or whatever it may be, who tells the patient, no, and absolutely do not use this, it's horrible for you. Not one who says, you know what, maybe for you, you won't want to use it because the side effects may outweigh the benefit. That's not what I'm saying. But if one says, no, this absolutely doesn't work, and giving advice that clearly defies all scientific fact, right? Yeah, that's exactly a case where a patient can say, I was harmed. My physician gave me information that was absolutely wrong. I've sought second and third opinions, and everyone who I've talked to has said this is wrong. This is how I was harmed. Please investigate. These are processes that exist today for that exact reason. And there's no reason why they couldn't be employed for COVID as well, should something like that happen. But I don't see that being how they'd like to apply it here. I think there's a broader intent to single out this one disease for political reasons as a way of silencing those who try to just simply go against what the governor and some of his colleagues like to say.
So does Newsom sign it? I mean, he has, you can talk about this a little more. He's taken his veto pen to something recently. Is there a chance he does that with this?
There's always a chance that he'll go against this and veto it. What makes it unlikely in my mind for this to happen is that who's been pushing this? You see trial lawyers pushing this who make money filing malpractice suits, who would greatly benefit by having government action against the physician. It's basically a slam dunk in any malpractice case when the physician has been disciplined by the medical board. It really goes, it's an additional proof that the standard of care was breached and harm was done. Otherwise, the medical board wouldn't necessarily go after that physician. You see, you know, media outlets applauding it, right? You see so many others who are on the governor's side and so many other things and who support the governor financially and politically supporting AB2098. So why in the world would the governor go against his supporters here and cause them harm? This is a great way to reward many of his closest supporters The only reason why I think he may not support it is if the political backlash is measured to be so hard against him for his gubernatorial run, but more importantly, for any potential national runs for president or even U.S. Senate, that he decides, like he did with that safe drug injection bill that he vetoed that you mentioned before, that for him politically, the harm outweighs any of the benefits within California. I doubt that that'll be the case with this, however.
Oh, well, Dr. Mahdi, we appreciate it. You know, and I think the reason, whatever California does, our governor just can't help but copy. It's like a thing. It's a pattern. So I think we're watching out to see if something similar pops up this legislative session. We do have our nurses board put out guidance that was very similar. It wasn't something, a law passed by politicians, but there is kind of a misinformation, disinformation guidance for nurses and doctors here around COVID that we have a public disclosure request in on. But we'll see if a law gets through in Washington State. And if it does, we'll have you back on. We appreciate your time and your expertise.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So as I mentioned there, Washington State has a similar policy for doctors and nurses. It's not a formal piece of legislation, but that addresses misinformation and disinformation and the spreading of it in regards to COVID-19. So as I told you on Friday, we reached out to the Department of Health to ask whether there have been any complaints against doctors or nurses in Washington State, and if so, if there's been any disciplinary action against them for spreading information that was deemed to be inaccurate about COVID. They informed us we would have to go through a public disclosure request for that information. So we will do that and let you know what we find. All right, we like to close the show on Mondays by sharing some comments that you guys had about segments that we've done in regard to my thoughts on trying to keep our own house in order, expecting more of our own party, and you know, not engaging in this race to the bottom. John wrote, if people would just understand the simplest of principles, Republican or Democrat, they're just two sides of the same coin. In some instances, I tend to agree with that. Carrie says, we're being played by all of them. Beth says, this is why I respect you so much. Extreme views and policies on both sides of the fence are the problem. Thank you for keeping it real. It sucks to feel stuck in the middle politically. It does. But that's when I know, like, I've hit something on the head, when the right's mad at me and the left's mad at me. And I'm just like, well, that's what happens when you have moral consistency. Let's see. Roxanne says, I wish we had better to choose from. No one wants to run. And I do believe that that's a problem. I think you have a lot of people who would make great politicians in this country. But either, you know, financially, they're worried that it doesn't pay enough. Or they're like, I'm sane. Why would I want to enter that world of insanity? And that is one of the reasons I'm so concerned about the degradation of our quality of discourse, is because sane people aren't going to want to be involved in that. I mean, look at some of these political campaigns and how crazy they get, like the Senate race in Pennsylvania. And it's like, why would I, you know, I'm a functioning adult, a professional who excels in my career field, why would I want to get involved in politics? So I totally agree, Roxanne. That is a huge issue. Kevin says, great advice, Brandy. Too many human lemmings waiting for someone else to figure it out for them before they leap off the cliff. All right. Also, on Friday with friends, I had a fun guest on, my former security guard when I was with Q13, the one who made all the headlines during the 2020 riot in downtown Seattle because he snatched two stolen police rifles from two scrawny little rioters. He goes by Shooter Roogie, or the Weapon Snatcher. We had a really fun segment on Friday where we, you know, kind of reflected on just the craziness of that summer, whether he would have gone back and changed what he did. Anyway, so I got some comments on that. Charla said, that night was when I started following you. He is awesome. Let's see. Germ says, that man is a hero. He did what he had to do and what he had the skills for doing. Prevented two thugs from running around Seattle with guns. Terry says, the only two intelligent people in Seattle. Thanks, Terry. I think there are more intelligent people than just Shooter Ruga and I, but I appreciate the compliment. Shelley says, thank you for your heroic acts. You are amazing, in reference to the Weapon Snatcher. Dave said, the SPD can learn a lot from this gentleman. So anyway, a lot of people were really excited to hear from Shooter Ruga because I really hadn't had a conversation with him publicly since just after all that happened, and we featured him when I was working at Fox 13. So he's a really interesting guy. So if you haven't watched that interview from the Friday episode, please do so. I thought there was a lot of interesting interesting takeaways from it. All right, that's it for this episode of Undivided, this Tuesday episode. Since we're coming to a day late, Monday was a holiday, we will still have our regular subscriber-only episode tomorrow on Wednesday. So if you have not become a subscriber already, but you believe in this mission to give common sense a comeback, you can subscribe in two ways, patreon.com/undivided, or by becoming a contributor on my locals community, brandycruz.locals.com. It's $5 a month. You get 4 to 5 additional bonus episodes every single month, which is, I think, a pretty good deal. Undivided is presented by our founding sponsor, 1530 Mortgage. Pay them a visit at 1530mortgage.com.